The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. It's good to be with you here on this beautiful Monday afternoon. We're coming into the last few days of classes here at God's College. Final exams start up on Thursday, so lots of end-of-the-year festivities here in the next couple of weeks. Over the weekend, we had a new bird visit, the bird feeder, the massive wood pigeon, just a huge bird. I've never been a huge fan of pigeons. You kind of see them more on buildings in big cities and such, but this does have some accents of turquoise and a little bit of pink on the breast. But these two of them, they came in pairs, and then they showed up again this morning, the two of them. I assume the same two. In any event, it was funny to just watch them kind of hop around and to pick up the scraps on the ground, or the ground of the second level, that is. And then one of them even jumped up onto the bird feeder. He almost seemed too big for it. But in any event, to this point, I think the biggest bird to visit the feeder, that would be the magpie. And I think the wood pigeon now, there's the magpie, beautiful bird. Almost looks like a crow, I guess. Crows aren't especially beautiful, but the magpie comes, now the wood pigeon. And of course, in addition to that, most of them a lot smaller. Over the weekend, Key of David response, the wilderness years, that was from 2 weeks ago, 184 responses, which was a strong response for some of these new programs that were back off and running. And then this past weekend, a very basic program on the subject of prayer, the essential key to answered prayer, that brought in 217 responses. Sam was saying this morning that it's been a while that we've gotten, or since we've gotten, over 200. I think it's generally that Mystery of the Ages program that we've repeated like 20 times, that generally gets 200 responses or more. So it's nice to see another one on a very basic subject. We advertised the prayer booklet, I believe, and another piece of literature as well. So people are at home, but it's good to see them listening to this program or watching the Key of David, whether in the United States or here in the UK. Just one email I'll start with today. This is awesome, it says. My daughter was at a local dog park with her dog when an older gentleman on a bike was going by. She could plainly hear the Trumpet Daily playing on his headphones. She recognized your voice and could even tell which program he was listening to because she recognized the episode. Says, hopefully more and more people will be hearing these vital programs. How exciting. So that's a pretty funny experience, given that we have a relatively small audience compared to quite a few other programs. But it is growing. And of course, the thing that's so unique about this program is it brings in listeners from all over the world. It would be interesting, perhaps, to see just how many nations are covered in this audience. Well, the word unprecedented, I think you could say it's being used at an unprecedented rate. According to Google, there's been a massive spike in new websites using the word unprecedented. And you just put a list together here on this program, some of these topics we've covered in recent weeks, an unprecedented level or amount of government spending, government borrowing, and if you're in the United States, there's certainly an unprecedented amount of money printing going on right now. Some are projecting over $30 trillion in the national debt by the end of this year, because we're just printing off trillions and trillions of dollars. There have been tens of millions of jobless claims, and so a record number of unemployed in the United States. And of course, that's a worldwide trend, many comparing it to the Great Depression, And here it's self-inflicted, of all things. The cure is worse than the disease. You're seeing all of these peacetime restrictions on freedom. Unprecedented, certainly for the United States and Britain. When have we seen this? We're not even in the midst of a major full-scale war. And yet you see all of these liberties, all of these freedoms that we take for granted. And they've been suspended. There's an unprecedented decline in air travel. I was trying to get my flight to the States last night through Delta. They said the next flight available is May 29th. That's the end of this month, so 4 weeks away almost. And not because these are full flights. It's because all the flights are being canceled. Now, there's a few other airlines that have more options. But that's just one. And Delta, of course, that's a pretty big airline. An unprecedented decline in international travel. And then, of course, there's the number of people watching hours and binge-watching programming on Netflix, viewing pornography, video game use. And all the major sports, those have been canceled or postponed. When has that ever happened? I'd have to go back and look at some of the history there with World War II to see how many of the sports events were just canceled entirely. In the UK and in the United States, we're certainly seeing an unusual spike in the level of spying and snitching on neighbors. That's unusual. I don't know if you could say it's unprecedented. It probably is. And then, as I say, the word itself, it's being used over and over and over again. Unprecedented. And all brought on because of these models and a disease, but a disease that I think even the experts would agree now, it wasn't nearly as bad as we were told it would be, because the experts were way off. The Telegraph said today, doctors and researchers at Oxford University believe ministers became, this is speaking of the politicians in London, they became overly reliant on the crystal ball gazing and worst case scenarios from Imperial College and have continued ramping up capacity while ignoring what is actually happening in wards or actually happening in hospitals. And you can say the exact same thing for the United States. Just a catastrophic miscalculation on the part of the modelers, coming up with these absurd estimates. And yet we're still holding to them, incredibly. It's amazing to me that there haven't been more governors, politicians that have just come forward and said, you know what, we've got this wrong. We got it wrong from the beginning. So we're just going to lift these restrictions. It's ridiculous. Now, the restrictions are starting to be lifted, but if you'll hear here in a moment from Ohio, it's very careful in the way that these restrictions are being lifted. There's nothing abrupt about it. We went into it abruptly. We went into it headlong. Then we're in the midst of this total lockdown, and no one seems to have the courage to say, this is enough. We're killing ourselves. We've got to get back to work. This article at the Telegraph, by the way, it makes the point that, you know, building all these temporary hospitals, the things that we were supposed to do in anticipation of all the people that would flock to the hospitals and the thousands and thousands of people that would need ventilators, and the tens of thousands, the millions, in fact, that would die. And so the fixation early on was on the death count and on overburdening the hospitals. And yet throughout this crisis, the experts, they haven't really looked at what's actually happening at the hospitals. And we've covered a fair bit of that on this program. Ventilators, for example, they assumed at Imperial that 70% of those that got sick would need ventilators, and that's why people like Governor Cuomo in New York were just absolutely hysterical. We've got to get more ventilators. We need 30,000. We need 40,000. And then in the case of Cuomo, he wanted to blame President Trump for not getting him enough. For saying that, well, New Yorkers are going to have to die, I guess. In the end, of course, they ended up with all kinds of extras. This article makes the point that ventilators are so invasive as a medical procedure that it generally kills most old people. So a lot of doctors don't even put old people on ventilators. In fact, if you look at statistics for ventilators, on the whole, it's something like 80 to 90% of those put on ventilators die. It's almost like a death sentence. If you go on a ventilator, there's a good chance you're about to die. And early on in the crisis, as you remember, all of us do, we remember this. It was all about the ventilators. We've got to get these ventilators. Now the market, no doubt, is flooded with ventilators. The Telegraph says here, another doctor said that the original modeling, assuming 7 in 10 patients over 80 would be intubated or ventilated, was so far from real-world practice that it's kind of laughable. That's from the Telegraph today. These modelers, they're not even working in medicine. They're just building these models. Maybe they know a fair bit about viruses. Maybe they're epidemiologists. But did they know what was actually happening on the ground level at the hospitals, at the NHS, at the hospitals in the United States? Many hospitals that are now laying off tens of thousands of staff. In some cases, closing down. One doctor in this article is quoted as saying, "It appears they don't understand one of the guiding principles of intensive care, yet we're happy to make predictions about it without seeking expert opinion." This is a doctor. This is someone in the medical profession that said, why don't you come and get our opinion on this? Why don't you get our take? If you want to know what's happening on the ground, we're right here. Instead, it was the fixation was on the deaths. And so we've got to build up the London Nightingale Hospital. We've got to build up the Javits Center in New York. We've got to get more hospital beds in here. Well, they're looking into tearing down the London Nightingale now because they don't need it. They built temporary hospitals in Birmingham, Manchester, and Harrogate here in the UK. And guess how many patients those three temporary hospitals have? Zero. Zero. There's a picture. Not one patient. They put up all these makeshift facilities, and they haven't even used them. All these ventilators. We in the United States, we had companies stop producing cars or whatever else so that they could mass produce ventilators. Where are they going to put the ventilators? That's a good question. I'm curious. What will we do with all the excess ventilators? You know, those machines that are pretty much a death warrant. You go on that, you're about over. That's about it. Another article interviews a Nobel Prize scientist, Michael Levitt, and he points out how that Neil Ferguson's assumptions were so completely unrealistic, not based on evidence at all. And he makes the point, this Nobel Prize winner, that epidemiologists, they only are criticized if they underestimate deaths. And so if they come in and they overestimate it, and we're seeing this happen in real time, right? They come in and they wildly overestimate it, and then we get through it and we're like, oh boy, well, at least it's not 2 million. Well, at least it's not 600,000. And the epidemiologists, they continue right on making their paychecks. They get their paychecks every week, every other week, whatever it is. You think they're really concerned about the plague of joblessness? What was it, Fauci a couple weeks ago that said it was, I forget the word that he used, inconvenient, something like that. it is inconvenient for people to lose their jobs. Inconvenient? Would he say that if he lost his job? It's just a little inconvenience. Millions and millions of people. Here they make these wild overestimates. These wild calculations, peering into their crystal balls. And look at where we are today, bringing all of these nations into the disastrous state that we're in. As I say, it's just astounding to me that there aren't more leaders who are willing to speak up and say, we were wrong. We got bad information. Remember the governor in Ohio, and he had the Department of Health official alongside him, and he said, you know, we've got 100,000 cases of COVID-19 right now, and this is a disease that doubles every 6 days. And as I pointed out a couple weeks ago, that means we're already past the point of every single person in Ohio being infected with this disease every 6 days. So 11.7 million people in Ohio. And as of this morning, the total COVID-related deaths in Ohio, 1,040. They finally made it over 1,000, if you can put it that way. 1,040 people out of a state of 12 million. What's the percentage of the population in Ohio that has died of coronavirus? 0.008%. That's 0.001 of 1% that have died of this virus in Ohio. And he said that this would infect millions. And whatever percentage, the death rate, 3.4% if you take Tedros's estimate, or somewhere in the neighborhood of a flu, 0.1, well, there'd be tens of thousands of deaths. As of this morning, 1,040, and yet still you hear the ominous reports. The media, they'll never let this go. Listen to the way Martha Raddatz questions Governor Mike DeWine. He's the governor in Ohio, about the cases of COVID in Ohio and how this governor's bringing them out, finally, of the lockdown. Clip one.
Governor, you were on the early side of closures and have now taken a phased approach at reopening, with manufacturing and construction opening tomorrow and then retail the next week. You have had more than 19,000 cases of COVID, over 1,000 deaths, and have been in the downward curve, it looks like, for only about 4 or 5 days. But you have also had 1 million Ohioans file for unemployment. So tell me how you decided to reopen, how you balance that health risk versus economic risk.
Well, we're trying to do it very carefully. And, you know, we're trying to do two things at once. I told Ohioans Friday, I said, we can do two things at once. We can remain very, very careful, keep the social distancing, wear masks when out in public.
So the social distancing, that continues, but again, you get the tone. That, of course, the reporter, this is, boy, you've had 19,000 cases. Can you imagine if during influenza season, she's there saying, now, Governor, you've had 19,000 cases of the flu this winter. 1,000 people have died from this. Can you explain to me how you're coming out of the lockdown? And then there he is saying, it's very careful, it's very measured, it's slow going. We're trying to do two things at once. It's harder to come out of the lockdown, so much harder than it was to go into it. Going into it, no problem. Why? 100,000 have it now. It's going to double in 6 days. And if we go with Dr. Tedros, we're looking at tens of thousands of deaths. You see the difference? Now it's, well, we're still very, very concerned about 1,040. What about all the other effects? The joblessness and all of the social ills that come along with that. All of the social ills and even the violence and the death that comes along with a depression. What about that? It doesn't even factor into the conversation. You heard the reporter. Now, Governor, you have 19,000 that have gotten this sickness. And yet the reports are already coming in. If you just have eyes to see, the impact, the devastating impact the lockdown is having on entire communities, nations, in fact. BBC had a report recently about Italy, northern Italy, coming out of lockdown. They had the lockdown in place the longest, and they're just now beginning to come out of it. Here's a report from BBC, clip two.
Naples is a city of such spirit. But here, as across Italy, it's taken a real battering from the world's longest lockdown of the pandemic. The measures might now be easing, but the suffering isn't. Come and have a look at this, just one of the many social initiatives that sprung up here. If you've got food to donate, you leave it in this basket. If you're hungry or in need, you take the free food out of this one. Solidarity with a lot of social distancing.
This region, Campania, is one of the poorest in the European Union. Italy might be emerging from its lockdown, but it has left so many scars here.
So many scars. What about some of the poorest communities in these nations that have gone into total lockdown? And what about the ones who maybe aren't starving to death? On this report from BBC, a lot of it was in Italian. He's interviewing Italians. But there were at least three people in this video that essentially said that it would be better to die than to face what they're facing now with the repercussions of the lockdown. I would rather die than to have my livelihood taken from me, forcibly taken from me, by Big Brother, one Italian. This is in the worst in the world, excepting maybe Wuhan. Naples, Italy, or the city, I guess, that he walked through, one of the poorer cities. One resident said, "We had nothing before. Now they won't let us work. What's left? To die of hunger?" These are the after effects of the lockdown. Another one said, "My business is my life and it's failing. I'd rather be dead." There's a frontline report. There's a report from the front lines in case Neil Ferguson wants to go and gather a little data like this. And maybe this can be factored into the next model. If this is all it takes to completely shut down a nation, dozens of nations, hundreds. What happens when so many of the prophecies of God, Revelation 6, Matthew 24, there's prophecies about when the alarm sounds for battle, no one goes. No one even turns up to fight. And here are politicians and leaders and commentators today, concerned only about saving one life from COVID-19, and never mind those worrying about where their next meal might come from or whether they're going to ever have a job again. Isn't it easy for those who still have jobs, who are still making millions in front of the TV camera, isn't it easy for them to say, "Well, I know it might be a little bit inconvenient, but we got to do it. It's COVID after all. It's COVID-19. Here in the UK, Parliament today is going to finally debate the UK's lockdown regulations. Initially, of course, it was just brought on by Prime Minister Johnson's administration, emergency legislation. This goes back to late March. But after taking action as extreme as that, Parliament has 28 days after it comes back from recess to approve this. And it's going to go through Parliament. I'm not going to get anyone's hopes up. It'll fly through Parliament, but there are some reports today that show there's a small band of MPs that are very much going to challenge whether or not this was lawful. There's an article at the Telegraph. Steve Baker, writing in the piece, says Boris Johnson must end the absurd, dystopian, and tyrannical lockdown. This must end. It's absurd. It's destroying us. It's killing us. These are the reports. You're going to be hearing this for the next several weeks and months, and not just on this program. You'll hear the BBC reports like we just heard, coming out of Italy, coming out of wherever else. And it'll only confirm what we said in the recent trumpet. The cure is killing us. This same article says here, where the police enforced rules in the meantime, they were enforcing a proclamation. It's bringing out some of the same points we've noted before. It says, and this is quoting a PM, I believe, an MP, sorry. It says, whatever the necessities, that the rule of law should have been overthrown in this period is extraordinary and deeply troubling. Another one says, I'm horrified by the expansion of the surveillance state. Horrified by this. And then he talks about, the author does, the absurd dystopian tyranny. The sooner this ends, the better, he says. The sooner this is over, the better. The sooner we can get back to work, the better. And yet, judging by the polls, there's still quite a large majority here in the UK that would just as soon stay home. It's mind-boggling. And yet, when you look at the scaremongering leading up to this, I guess you can also understand it to some degree. In the United States, there's some signs that people are awakening to the fact that this is an unconstitutional power grab. There was a paper in California making the point, again, that if the country can be put through this with a virus, well, how much would it take for us to turn into the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany? We're already having to, as this article brings out, line up for things. There's, you know, items at the store that are empty or they're not available. You have helicopters flying over beaches on loudspeakers telling people to go home. This California piece, this article, is calling on people to confront, to protest, to stand against this, to get businesses back to work. Over the weekend, there was more protesting in Michigan. Right up to the Michigan State House, people that are just furious. Furious because of the actions that Governor Whitmer has taken. She was on Jake Tapper's show yesterday, by the way. Listen to, well, her response is one thing. Listen to the question here by Jake Tapper. This is clip 3.
These protests came after President Trump tweeted, liberate Michigan. He tweeted, quote, the governor of Michigan should give a little, put out the fire. He said that these are very good people about the protesters that were featured in the video, to which the executive director of the Jewish Democratic Council of America, Haley Sofer, who is from Lansing, Michigan, she compared those comments to President Trump referring to those marching alongside neo-Nazis in Charlottesville as very fine people. Is that how you see these protesters, in that vein, in that extreme?
Well, some of the outrageousness of what happened at our Capitol this week, depicted some of the worst racism and awful parts of our history in this country.
The protesting at the Capitol in Michigan, some of the worst racism. Tapper there is talking about Charlottesville. And of course, they've already only told a certain tiny sliver of that story. That was all about racism, the way they view it. And now these protests of people out there wanting their jobs back, people out there wanting their livelihoods back. That, if we're listening to what we're told as Americans, that's the American way, right? I mean, we're not here at this program or at the trumpet.com encouraging people to protest even. Our admonition is for people to turn to God in the midst of these crises. But for people that they don't have that hope, they don't have that focus, their hope is in the Constitution of the United States. Their hope is in the Bill of Rights. Free speech, freedom of assembly. If American liberties disappear, Well, that's the last bastion for freedom on Earth. Here Jake Tapper is saying the ones protesting are racist. They're not just dangerous because they're spreading a disease. They're now racist somehow. And the governor of Michigan agrees. Conservative commentator Candace Owens, she tweeted out yesterday. Apparently, Governor Whitmer believes she is a duly elected dictator of a socialist country. The people of Michigan need to stand up to her. Open your businesses, she tweeted. Go to work. The police think she's crazy, too. They're not going to arrest 10 million people for going to work. That's Candace Owens on Twitter. And Twitter, of course, promptly suspended her account. Oh, yes. You can't get to her. She's a rising star in the conservative party, the Republican Party. She's one of the more popular individuals on Twitter. And yet Twitter's political ideology, it swings so far to the left. It is so far in support of Governor Whitmer, who says all these protesters are racists, that they suspend this account from Candace Owens. You can't say protest. You can't say go back to work. If you're two doctors in California saying what's happening in your emergency room and that it doesn't justify these kinds of measures, you can't speak that message on YouTube. We've been over that one. Well, Twitter says that her tweet violated the platform's COVID-19 misinformation policy. How about that? How many tweets were there during the height of Black Lives Matter protests or Occupy Wall Street? Or the Trump resistance? Some of these protests that resulted in cities being trashed, vandalized, and in some cases, people killed. I wonder how many Twitter accounts that were out there stirring up those kinds of protests. I wonder how many of those accounts are still alive and well, still doing quite well. But if you're Candace Owens, a star in the Republican Party, perhaps a future leader in the Republican establishment, you can't tweet to protest at this. Not now. This is a pandemic. This has killed 1,040 people in Ohio. Neil Ferguson says that we're going to run out of ventilators, and we need makeshift hospitals all over the world. Those hospitals are now closing down. And even some of the permanent facilities are closing down. Imagine that, a pandemic and hospitals going out of business. Going out of business during a pandemic. This is what we're observing. A world that's totally backwards, upside down. Here's what the president said yesterday in his interview on Fox News, clip 4.
A lot of people want to go back. They just want to go back. You see it every day. You see demonstrations all over the country, and those are meaningful demonstrations.
They just want to go back to work, he said. So how soon that will happen remains to be seen. But what a world we're living in. Dramatic, earth-shaking events. The world just shaking. I'm sure that's why there's a pretty good response to some of these programs that we're putting out. Because people are concerned. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
But as far as bringing America together, do you think you're doing that?
I think we're winning very big, and then we had a horrible thing happen. We're winning bigger than we've ever won before, Brett. And I think that winning ultimately is going to bring this country together. I'm shocked that during a crisis it would be so partisan. You know, when you see all these committees, seven or eight committees we haven't even started, and they have all these committees looking for trouble, just looking for trouble. Every enemy I have is put on a Democrat committee. And I was surprised. You know, they did the impeachment hoax. It was a total hoax over a phone call that was a perfect call.
That's the president last night in his interview with Fox News saying that he was shocked. He's shocked that the country, while in the midst of a crisis, is so deeply and bitterly divided, so partisan. So here we are, 9/11, you could see both sides trying to come together, at least for a short time. But you haven't seen that this time. You see how it's politicized through and through. You can see it in the way blue states react to this crisis, as opposed to red states. And then there's the president in the middle, trying to please the experts, trying to please both sides. And he's shocked. He's shocked at how divided we are. Does this bode well for the United States of America? Here we've put our faith, our trust, our confidence in what the experts have to say. And look at where we are. The experts just making catastrophic mistakes. Mistakes that will, even if there's a mini resurgence to come, these are mistakes that will never fully recover from. The cure is killing us. If you look at Genesis 11, this is the story about the Tower of Babel, God intervening in human affairs back in the 11th chapter of Genesis, intervening to postpone what we see threatening our nations today. There is no postponement today. In Genesis 11, there was. Verse 1 says, and the whole earth was of one language, of one speech. So they were all speaking the same thing. It seemed like they were coming together. They were unified. They all had the same response. Everyone's doing it. Well, this is just what we're supposed to do. Verse 4, and they said, go, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto the heaven, and let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. So this was an effort to keep everybody united. And you know bad things are about to happen when human beings or human organizations get in there and say, this is what we need to do to stay together. The president, as he said there, he's shocked. Here it's a pandemic. It's a crisis. And look at how bitterly divided we are. Verse 5, it says, and the Eternal came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men builded. All this progress. And how did God respond? Well, he took some pretty decisive action. Verse 7, it says, go to, let us go down and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Eternal scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. So they stopped this project. God frustrated their plans. God slowed the acceleration of this evil progress. They were making a lot of progress. They had one language. They were all coming together on this massive project. And God put a stop to it. God confounded the languages. Verse 9 says, therefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Eternal did there confound the language of all the earth. And from thence did the Eternal scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. Babel, of course, meaning confusion. He confused them. He slowed the progress of evil. There was progress of technology as well. But God had to intervene, because with this progress of technology came an acceleration of evils. That's the way it always is with human nature. Notice why God took this action. Backing up to verse 6, it says, and the Eternal said, behold, the people is one, and they have all one language. And this they begin to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them, which they have imagined to do. There's not going to be any restraint. So they're all progressing. Technology, the advances of medicine, education, science, but no restraint. God scattered them, as it says in the correspondence lesson, to restrain the misguided, inventive genius of man. Man has been inventive. There's a lot of human ingenuity that you look at the modern world, and there are modern marvels for sure. But look at the evil. God had to intervene here to prevent the rapid acceleration of evil. One listener sent me this article from the Telegraph last week. It says, man 2.0, as in denial, is in denial, I should say, about where he comes on the civilizational timeline. Drowning in gadgetry and doped up on antidepressants, he falsely views science as a sort of black magic, a force that can solve all problems. What does this sound like? If you've been reading Herbert Armstrong's literature for very long, you know what this sounds like. To solve all problems, this science, this black magic, and ultimately to save him even from the terror of his own death. We have to put our faith in science, so that we don't die of COVID-19. It says, this coupled with the rise of managerialism in politics has created an unhealthy feedback loop with a public that expects to be shielded from all risks, and a political class that justifies its existence based on the myth that it can manage such dangers. Don't you worry, you ordinary sheeple. Just stay in your houses, and we'll protect you. We'll make sure that you're shielded from all risks. Now, you compare that Telegraph piece to Mr. Armstrong. This goes back to 1964. Listen to this. He says, science does not have the answers. Science turns out to be a false messiah, after all. A false messiah? Mr. Armstrong, he had quotes like this even before 1964. He saw where modern science was taking us. Modern education. He says, let's ask education. Thoughtful men have said that knowledge is the one solution to all our ills. Give us sufficient knowledge, they say, and all problems will be solved. Look, we've got some sophisticated knowledge here. We've got some scientific models here. Well, but wait a second. Can you come into the ward first and look at the number of hospital beds and the number of ventilators? And maybe we can tell you, too, about what happens when you're put on a ventilator, and how that we don't put elderly on them because it's such an invasive procedure. No, I don't need any of that. We've got the models. Just build the makeshift facilities. Just stop producing cars at GM and tell them to produce ventilators. And so they did. False Messiah. He says, look first at the colleges and universities where this education is being disseminated. Student enrollments are on a rapid increase at an all-time high, but also there's a rapid rise in discontent, disillusionment, a sense of hopelessness, and a what's the use attitude. Well, and he goes on. He goes on and on. Further on, he says, will knowledge solve all the problems in the world's ills? The knowledge acquired by these people has not brought world peace. Why won't science acknowledge this? The knowledge acquired by these people has not stopped the spread of disease. We certainly see that. The solution, it's always the vaccine. And has that put an end to disease? Well, maybe scientists would say, yes, yeah, in some cases, a few. And yet, look at all these new ones. We can't keep up with it. The rush is on now to try to build a vaccine or to develop a vaccine by the end of this year. And so when we get that for COVID-19, what happens with the next one? He says the knowledge acquired by these people, it hasn't ended world hunger. It hasn't brought health, happiness, and joy. It's a false messiah. Or as the Telegraph put it, it's science as a sort of black magic. Science will solve everything. God intervened in Genesis 11. He's not intervening this time. To slow the pace, I mean. He will intervene just before we nearly annihilate ourselves. That's Matthew 24, 21, and 22. Notice 1 Corinthians 8 and verse 1. It says, now as touching things offered unto idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Paul says, knowledge puffs up, but godly love edifies. Knowledge puffs up. Knowledge in and of itself, it just makes us more vain and arrogant. If we're not seeking truth, the truth based upon God's revelation, and then speaking the truth in love, as it says in Ephesians 4:15, then what is it other than just vanity? Vanity of vanities. There's a proverb that says, pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. Look at the pride. Look at the vanity. Another one says, before destruction, the heart of man is haughty, and before honor is humility. Proverbs 29:23, a man's pride shall bring him low. Another one, when pride comes, then comes shame. You see, like I said in the first segment, where's the humility? Where is the, you know what, I think we got it wrong. I think we got it wrong. I know I'm a governor. And look, I hope that you'll understand. We were basing it on these models. There's none of it. Governor, you have 19,000 cases. How do you balance between this and this? And then you hear it. Well, it's very careful. We still have to be vigilant. We have to come out of this in very measured steps. Meanwhile, you have these reports coming out of northern Italy. And people saying, I'd rather die. I'd rather die than have this on a daily basis. No sense of urgency now coming out of this nightmare. Going in, yes, the urgency was certainly there. And it was based upon science as a sort of black magic. Verse 2, it says, and if any man think that he knows anything, he knows nothing yet as he ought to know. It's quite a... Well, that puts it in perspective, doesn't it? You compare us to God, our Maker, and God's Word says, if any man thinks he knows anything, he knows nothing. He doesn't know anything. It's kind of like Job.
In Job 38, when God said to him, "Where you think you know so much? Where were you when I laid the foundations of this earth?" Listen to yourself. You think you're this spectacular, you know, intellect, this scholar, this great builder of pyramids, this architect, this genius. And God says, you know nothing. You know absolutely nothing. Where is the humility in these people, in these scholars, in these educators, in these commentators? You don't hear it. You don't hear it. You just see and hear a lot of intellectual vanity. We know. Don't tell me about the track record. Well, governor, says one reporter to the governor of Illinois, we understand you've got some pretty serious lockdown orders in place, but now your family's flying back and forth to Florida. Does that kind of violate your own standards? I'm not even going to address that. Family is off limits. What should my family have to do with the laws I've put in place? That's his response, basically. He knows. Not an ounce of humility. Not 1 ounce of it. Verse 3, it says, but if any man love God, the same is known of him. But if one loves God, the Revised Standard says, one is known by him. You see, this is what God is saying here. This is what impresses me. If you have a love for God, then I take note of that. If it's just about accumulating knowledge, if it's just about the pursuit of knowledge, if God's not part of that, well, then it's just vanity. Pure and simple. Isaiah 5 and verse 20, notice this. It says here, woe unto them that call evil good and good evil and put darkness for light and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. See, woe unto them that just turn everything upside down. They turn it. That's what they want to do. In the family, they want to turn that upside down. In the workforce, they got to turn that upside down. In medicine, deal with the effect. Find the poison to cancel out the other poison. Just turn everything upside down. Never mind the cause. Let's just turn it all upside down. And God says, woe unto them that do this. Verse 21, woe unto them that are wise in their own eyes, I should say, and prudent in their own sight. Woe unto them who just place their trust and their confidence in men. Jeremiah 17, verse 5. It's a will worship. It's the worship of self. It's the worship of the devil, if you want to look at the root cause. Satan's the god of this world. Human nature, we just love to do evil, and then to feel better about ourselves, we call it good. Have you noticed this? We love to do evil. We love to eat and live any way that we want. And then in the end, the evil, the real evil that we've got to go after is this infectious disease. And the way to go after it is a total lockdown and a vaccination. And that takes us out of the equation. We didn't do anything wrong, did we? Woe unto them, God says, who call evil good and good evil. Notice 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 4. This is from Paul's letter to the Corinthians. He says, charity, we read about that in 1 Corinthians 8. Charity or godly love, it suffers long, it's kind. God's love envies not. Charity vaunts not itself, is not puffed up. It's not high-minded, as it says in 2 Timothy 3. God's love, it flows out from self. It's an unselfish, outflowing concern for others, for God first and foremost, and for God's family, and for the whole world. It's the way of give. Verse 8 says, charity never fails, but whether there be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. In the Moffat translation, it says, love never disappears. That's verse 8. As for prophesying, it will be superseded. As for tongues or languages, they will cease. There's going to be one pure language in the world tomorrow. So knowing all these different languages, that's not going to be necessary. And then it says, as for knowledge, it will be superseded. Even knowledge, God says here. If you don't have love, if you don't speak the truth in love, then what good is it? Knowledge shall vanish away. It's going to be far surpassed by God's perfect knowledge, God's revealed knowledge. When God's knowledge covers the earth, as the oceans cover the sea, that's coming in God's wonderful world tomorrow, in God's coming kingdom. If it's not motivated by love, it's just vanity. If it's God's knowledge, and out of love, we want to give it to the whole world, well, then there's something that really has purpose and meaning. And that's what brings purpose and meaning, ultimately, into your life. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you want to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We thank you for joining us on today's program, and we'll see you tomorrow.